The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
So for this Butati today, we are having a what we call a faculty panel, although we have a special guest who's a board member rather than a faculty panel. And it gets an opportunity of seeing different people discuss an issue of importance. So I'm going to introduce the panel to you. We have Pastor Doug Wilson, MA Director, Pastor of Christchurch, who is in the throes of writing a book on food, I believe. So Pastor Wilson, we have Francis Fukushan, who has written a book on food and was a chef in France and in Moscow, Idaho. I remember very clearly my very first visit here, eating at West of Paris. For a long time and enjoying it very much. And we have a member of faculty, Peter Escalante, who is Fellow of Rhetoric. So, gentlemen, if you'd like to come up to the table, and I will get to ask you difficult questions. So the topic today that we're going to discuss, and which you'll have opportunity to ask questions, is food, or food and faith. Now, we all eat. Some of us eat too much. Some of us probably eat too little. But we all eat food. And we all have to think about what we eat, why we're eating. It's not an area that's outside of what it means to be a Christian. Okay? And so there are lots of related issues to do with food, which we're going to discuss today. But before we do, we have sort of three different perspectives. We have a pastor, we have a pastor stroke chef, and then we have Mr. Escalante. I want you to give 3 minutes or so from your perspective on what's a sort of standout important thing to think about when we think of food as Christians. Just one standout point, and we'll go from right to left. So we'll start with Pastor Wilson, and we'll come and finish with Peter Escalante.
As far as I'm concerned, the central issue with regard to food is fellowship. Not so much what's on your plate or what's on the table, but rather who's across the table from you. So who are you communing with? God has created us in such a way that fellowship is tightly tied to food. We have that in the Lord's Supper, obviously, but we also have it in common words like companion, which comes from with basically someone who shares bread with you. Panis is the Latin word for bread. So if you break bread together, if you eat together with someone, you are fellowshipping with them. Scripture underscores this. It's better to have a meal of scrawny vegetables and peace than to live in a house where there's sumptuous food and strife and discontent. So basically, my concern about the modern foodie movement is that it's for the sake of the aesthetics or the purity or the localism of the food, people are willing to disrupt fellowship across the table. So my primary interest is a person's spiritual standing with God is not affected by what they put in their mouth, by what they eat. Maybe Cheese Whiz out of a can, but just don't do that. But other than that, basically, I believe that we are not put right with God by what we eat. We are put right with God. We display how we have been put right with God by how we eat and with whom we eat.
Well, I agree with Doug. But I wouldn't say it's not either or, it's both. It does start with obviously God, the creator, but I think there is a lot of room where I believe you, my dear fellow Americans, have a lot to go, a long way to go.
Amen.
We invented Cheese Whiz out of a can.
Well, the interesting thing is seeing the place of food in the French mindset. It's being said that the French live to eat, Americans eat to live, vice versa. But it's interesting to see the place of food. I was trained, first of all, as a chef with one of the top Michelin star chef in Lyon, France. And before I went to seminary, so I fed the bodies before I fed the souls. And we actually came to this place because of NSA, by the way. That's the reason why I've been here. But this training that I had at first really reminded me, as when I became a Christian, how pagans are using food, and mostly French, who are very pagan. And unfortunately, I'm missing a big part of it, is what Doug just was saying. But I'll say also that typically Americans are missing the boat as well. Seeing the place of food in creation, you see that right in the beginning, when God created everything, He created man, He put him in this amazing garden, and you see the incredible variety of foods and colors and texture and everything. And of course, then came meat and so forth. And so you see food from the beginning as a very important element. We don't just eat grass like the deer just eat grass, and the fish just eat raw fish without salt and pepper, you know? And really, God gave us an incredible ability to create what He gave us, raw ingredients, to make something amazing and beautiful. So even in the fall, we have that incredible demonstrations when the Israelites were sent out in the desert. They complained because of the manna. Would you have the same thing every day? Remember what they were thinking about. In Egypt, in slavery, the onions, the leeks, the garlic, the melons, everything they were missing. We see the place of food, how important it was. And then the promise of going out of that wilderness was the promised land, full of milk and honey. So we see that this is not just something that, by the way, we need some food. And obviously, everything aimed at Christ and the supper of the Lamb. And I can guarantee you, this supper is not going to be an American meal. It's going to be definitely made by the French, you know. You overheard the story of, in hell, who would be the cooks? The British, right? I love you, brother.
I'm just standing here minding my own business. I said amen to his comment earlier, and...
But in heaven, the French would be the cook. And then, of course, if there are any German here, the German would do the entertainment in hell, and they'd be the order in heaven, and the Italian will be the order in hell, and the Italian would do the entertainment in heaven. Anyway, the French have really learned something, and what I really want to come across is pagan France has something to teach us as Christians about the place of food and how important it is. So it's spiritual, it's very also down to earth. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, it has been made abundantly clear I'm neither a pastor nor a chef, but I've been eating since I was born, so I can maybe lay claim to some minimum expertise. I agree entirely with what my friends have said here, and I especially think that Pastor Wilson has hit the nail on the head by saying what's at stake is fellowship. What I would perhaps add is that chief of all is the question of our fellowship with God. And although we certainly aren't justified by what goes in our mouth, insofar as we are glorifying God by giving doing something well, serving others by serving them food, and thanking Him for what He has brought to our table, there are questions of production that we have to consider, at least as a kind of poetics. As someone I think has said, it's not so much that modern praise music is necessarily heretical, but it's bad poetry, and God cares about bad poetry. So with regard to our fellowship with God in the matter of food, I think there's that to consider. And I would also say that, you know, it's a common evangelical blessing to say, you know, bless that, you know, bless this food, O Lord, to our, you know, the use of our bodies, bless the hands that made it, and also the hands which have, you know, brought it to our table, meaning from farm all the way to table. And we have to think about them as well. Now, they're somewhat more remote. There's no question about that. Our companions across the table are really what matters right off. If you are out of fellowship with someone because you are eating arugula and they are eating the ice cream sandwich they got for $1.50 from the drugstore, you know, refrigerator, then clearly you're sinning. But I don't know that that means that you shouldn't, at some part of your mind, think, you know, if the guy, I do care enough for him to think that if he's eating nothing but processed sugar, that's not best for him. And that doesn't involve a breaking of communion or even a condescension necessarily, but it's a secondary kind of care. I think, first of all, you should enjoy, if you're eating arugula salad, you should enjoy your arugula salad, and you should enjoy that he's enjoying his ice cream sandwich. And any concerns about how much corn syrup is going into his body over decades is a secondary, even tertiary consideration. But what I would like to say is I think it's not a consideration. I think now we're going to be provoked by our moderator, is the plan.
There's lots of things to pick up on there. One of them is the issue of quality. And so when we put things in our mouths, or we put things on our table for people to eat, you know, Francis and Petita have picked up on, I think there's a general agreement, there's a slight on the importance of the quality of what you put on your on the table. There are the different qualities of food. You've said cheese in a can is not good. What else? On an aesthetic level, it's not good. I mean, it's just horrible. I mean, it's just...
Depends on how hungry you are.
That is true. Should that matter to us as Christians? Does the quality of the food and the preparation of the food and thing matter?
So let me kick this off. I would say, of course it matters. Anybody who wants to be reformational and anybody who wants God to be glorified to the maximum extent in everything we do should want to strive for excellence in everything we do. So the difficulty is, as fallen beings, as people who still struggle with their sanctification, our trouble is always, perennially, how to strive for excellence without becoming snobs. Because when we become snobs, we become enemies of the very excellence we are trying to promote. So if someone strives for excellence in music, that's great, but if he becomes a music snob, he becomes the enemy of musical advancement. If someone becomes a language snob, they get in the way, they're underfoot. If someone becomes a culinary snob, that breaks fellowship with people. So I would say that we ought to make as much progress in aesthetic development, in presentation, in everything we can do to grow and mature without sacrificing other things like personal relationships with people who don't agree with you, who belong to a different school of thought, or who've never thought about it a day in their lives. So the person who's never thought about it is the guy with the ice cream sandwich. A person who might be a fellow foodie with you, but it's not arugula salad, it's whatever, you know, dead seaweed sort of thing, or, you know, some art salad, and you've got different schools of thought, and then you have disruption of fellowship. So strive for as much excellence as you can attain while maintaining fellowship with all your people. And that means you can't turn up your nose at them. You just can't be a snob.
So can I ask a clarifying question, Pastor Wilson? So you're talking about those who are already striving for excellence. It's a kind of a vice of those who realize there's a God, he has standards, I need to live up to them, and the devil comes on, you know, traditionally to the left shoulder,
yeah,
and says, hey, this makes you really excellent, and aren't you great? And by the way, this other person is a sinner, and let's go kneel in the temple and start doing that business.
Right.
I wonder whether we could oppose to the figure of the snob the figure of the slob and sort of ask who's got the greater numbers in the world around us? Because it seems to me that with either the Christian Pharisee, the Christian food Pharisee, or the secular food Pharisee who has got some kind of post-Christian thing going on, right? I mean, he wouldn't be doing this if he didn't have some notion of excellence that's you know, higher than just not caring at all.
Yeah.
And so your concerns are pastoral concerns about this kind of behavior, primarily among believers, but you would also point it out among non-believers. But do you think that there are more snobs than slobs who just are totally unreflective about it. I'm not calling ice cream sandwich eaters all slobs, by the way. I'm just saying those who are unreflective about it at all and don't that's not enter their mind.
So I would agree with you, there's a ditch on both sides of the road, and to be slovenly and to be a slob is just as, it's the ditch on the other side. But at least in our community, every restaurant I go to has a menu that bows and scrapes to the foodies. Little chalkboards, locally grown this, locally grown that. If we live in a society that is consumed with virtue signaling, and 80% of our virtue signaling has to do with food. I just think that we have a terrible time with it, and I think that we do have a constituency that doesn't care the way they ought to care about food, about presentation, about cooking. That population is there and not insignificant. But in our circles, in our town, our college town, in our college educated circles, I would say the foodie end is far more of a pastoral problem to me than the other. So I've had to deal with divorces and fractured families because people have food manias but I've never had to pick up the pieces of a family or a marriage because everybody got their stuff at Walmart. I've not had to deal with that.
More female funerals, perhaps.
Yeah. well, I think we'll know that in another couple of decades.
So it does sound, though, as though you're saying that this is a context-specific emphasis, and that if you were dealing with a different context, like say you were, let's say we suddenly, got some third-party president that none of us could foresee but could only dream of, and he taps you of all people and he says, Reverend Wilson, I want you to be the food pundit
for the food czar
for the United States. You're going to be the C. Everett Koop of food. Might your emphases look different, at least somewhat different than they do now?
Yes, if you're talking about the whole nation, yes, absolutely. But when we look at, I'm pastoring where I am. I'm pastoring in the demographic where I pastor. I believe that, and food, at our house, food is a big deal. My wife's a great cook. We do a Sabbath dinner every Saturday night. We have probably 30, our baseline is 35 people with no company. And Nancy cooks, food's a big deal. One time I saw her in the laundry room, she was ironing, and she does cloth napkins for pretty much every meal. She was in the ironing napkins, cloth napkins. I said, why are you doing that? And she said, it's reformational. So we want to up our game, we want to do it as best we can, and when we started doing that, we weren't dealing with all the, we were pushing in that direction because the main problem was lethargy. But now it's not lethargy at all. It appears to be a Pharisaism that's pushing the other way. And I see it as a threat to true striving after food excellence.
Francis, can I bring you in here? And we put in the situation where you strive for excellence, you'll spend 48 hours working on a stock for a dinner, mm-hmm. and you're someone you know, a friend who eats ice cream sandwiches. How do you avoid falling into the ditch either side and yet want to educate? Because NSA is about education. Doug, you're all about education. You know, we want to train people, want reformation to come. So Francis, how do you approach that difference? You know, you've critiqued American society generally with a very fine brush. how do you go about doing it without falling into the food snob worry that Doug has got about?
Well, I think it's been said already, there are two ditches you want to avoid. And as a Christian, you want to raise the bar without falling in either of these ditches. So my experience here has been more raising the bar, because I really believe for so many people, food was fuel for the body. And I said, no, God created us with something so much better. Therefore, it's like painting. If I'm going to spend time doing some painting, I can just throw paints on the, whatever you call it, and say, yeah, modern art. Or you can really work for hours watching, observing, and working a long time on that beautiful piece of painting. And I think you talk about the 40-hour stock, where I tell you what you do when you create a stock that cooks for 40 hours. It's a vita stock mostly. It's called the king, the heart of the king of the sauces, and that was my specialties. You have done something that honors God without falling in the trap of, okay, now I'm better than you are across the street because you are using powder to do the same dish. Now, I say shame on you, but I'm not going to get after him. I'm going to say, you can do better than that. But you have to put priorities. And I think food is a matter of priorities without falling on either sides. You know, if your budget doesn't allow you to do better than a peanut butter sandwich, at least make it beautiful on the plate. And just don't gulp it. Just enjoy it slowly and worship God through that. But there are time where you deserve more than that. If you can afford, if you can do it, then take the time to do something beautiful that honors and glorifies God, which is a 5-course meal, long prepared, beautifully presented, and delicious, and that stays with you. You are showing love by doing such a thing.
So, Francis, you would say that what it all should have in common, would, and I think Pastor Wilson would say this too, obviously, is love and service.
Yes.
Right? And so beyond that, it's going to be sort of adiaphora, right? I mean, not everyone cooks like him. Although whenever I hear his voice, I always want to hear him say, anyone can cook. but really, not everyone can cook like him. I know this for a fact.
Anyone can cook. That is true.
but not everyone like him. So what any good use of food would have in common then would be love and service. I think we're all agreed on that. If that's not the point, then something has gone terribly, terribly wrong. And so we could grant that there's better and worse maybe by way of nutritional quality. There's certainly better and worse by way of taste or aesthetics. But some poor person who's just serves, they're in the habit of serving mac and cheese with some bad bacon stirred into the mix. If they're doing this in love and they're very hospitable, this is a much better thing than someone who's a 5-star chef who hates humanity.
Absolutely.
Right? So those are our basic parameters that we've got to work with.
And there are proverbs in the Bible that describes exactly that. So absolutely.
Okay. So there was an article written back 2009 by Mary Eberstadt called "Is Food the New Sex?" where she talked about within 2 generations you have this transformation from a society that was puritanical about sex and it, but didn't really care what food you ate, and now in this generation, you're puritanical about what you eat. They don't care, they're completely licentious about sex. And she seemed to think that her thesis was that they felt disconcerted about their attitude towards sex and they were making up for it by their puritanical attitude towards food. You know, you make yourself feel good if you eat arugula over and against an ice cream, but it doesn't matter who you sleep with or those sorts of things. The underlying assumption there on one level is that morality doesn't apply to food. Now, the question is, does it? Is there a point where there is a moral right and wrong connected with food in some way or other?
Bad oysters.
Bad oysters? No, is there a morality tied to food? Or is that outside of the field and wrong?
I would say that there is no morality to be centered in food with regard to the nouns. It's all in the adverbs, how you do it.
Okay.
Jesus declared all foods clean. Peter had the sheet lowered to him in a vision declaring all foods clean. That's part of the reason we can tell that there's a resurgent, and this is a slander on the Puritans, but a resurgent Puritanism with regard to food, is because we are trying to create holy, unholy divisions where God has declared everything clean. Now, the moral consideration for us is in how we love God, how we prepare, how we invest our talents so that we can get really good at something. That's all in the adverb. But if someone prepares watermelon, someone else prepares gourmet mac and cheese, someone else does, there's nothing that you can put, you can't locate sin on the plate. You can locate sin in the kitchen.
I love that formulation of not in the nouns, but in the right. Adverbs. So I guess my question to you would be, beyond the kitchen, let's say the case of the bad oysters. I'm as much a foe of government overreach as anyone, but you know the reason why historically we came up with the health department idea. Right. And so if someone is preparing, if someone's an oyster salesman or a restaurateur or whatever, and they're habitually handling oysters in a way where we know that's going to go bad, and there's going to be some risk that you could get food poisoning from it. Would you say that's clearly a moral, that's yes. One of those moral adverbs?
I would say that that's a moral adverb, and so there's sin involved, and I also think that there should be, that crime gets involved at some point. So if it's, I believe that cooks and food producers and factories should be liable for damage that they cause through not following best practices on how they prepare the chicken or how they prepare, you know, whatever. I'm a libertarian, economic libertarian, more than I don't want an anticipatory state going in to inspect you beforehand, but I do believe that the government should define weights and measures. This is what a pound of ground beef is. This is what the definition is. This is what constitutes a cleaned chicken. They define the standard. And then if that standard is violated and someone dies or gets deathly ill, then if they can show that the standard was violated, then I believe that they should be able to collect damages from the farmer or the rancher or the producer. So I think that morality is involved in the production chain, provided you prove it.
Francis, can I ask one clarifying thing? Yeah. So I would sign on to all of that, but as a libertarian, then you would have concerns about if, for instance, very large industrial agriculture corporations were buying off the government.
Oh yeah.
Or not buying off in some kind of completely shady behind the Hollywood sort of way, but if they're lobbying for what are in effect loopholes or relaxed restrictions, yeah. You would be opposed to that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I call that system crapitalism.
Okay.
So,
crapitalism.
Yes, because what you do is you have a regulation. The big companies are the ones who can hire the lawyers to help write the regulations, and then they get a cozy arrangement. And I'm very much opposed to that. I believe in free markets. And I believe that if someone abuses their freedom in how they produce the food and someone dies and someone can show that it was their negligence, then they should pay for that.
Yes, and I'm with you, Doug, on that. Interestingly, that when the government gets involved with food, it's really bad news. It's not always to protect you, actually, it's to control you. And I've seen the irony of some kitchens who have passed all the regulations were absolutely filthy and would not put my food in that restaurant. But they passed all the regulations, and at the same time, the food could be really oysters that are not fresh. The problem, the complexity of that responsibility whenever there's a problem is that because of the way the market works today, if you had food that's being sent to you frozen and has traveled, the average food travels between 1,500 to 2,500 miles once it starts towards the end, it gets on your plate. That food has been transferred so much and sometimes frozen and defrosted, you don't know as a restaurant owner. So I say, when you talk about the morals of food, it's not so much, I think the government should not be so involved with it, but I say it's us, the consumer, to be up to us to be checking out. I like to walk through the kitchen when possible. I always actually try to see what's happening in the kitchen. If the chef is clean, if the kitchen is clean, it's supposed to be a lab, then I'm feeling safe to be there. But also, I will be encouraging people who aim at excellence to say, try to cook food, not because it's popular local food. I understand this is becoming the in word, but for the reason of having something that you can watch growing, and you know that it's fresh enough that it goes from that place to your clean kitchen. To me, that's a moral choice right there. It's protecting and honoring your clients when you know that you have, you know where the food comes from, and you know the delay from that food to your plate is very limited and short. So to me, that's a moral, it touches the moral aspect.
I would only add that if they won't let you walk through the kitchen, then just walk through the bathrooms.
Absolutely.
So we don't trust the government.
Not at all.
Good. We don't trust large food industry corporations necessarily.
I don't trust them when they're in cahoots with the government.
They probably.
If they're on their own, basically, if a large corporation is functioning in a free market, yeah, I don't have a trouble trusting them, because I believe. Not trusting them absolutely, but I believe that in a competitive situation, if they start to slide, a competitor is going to come along and make them up their game.
Okay, so would a morality, would you be, think the questions of factory farming, treatment of animals, the way perhaps the excessive use of chemicals and all those things in order to guarantee a large crop, in order to guarantee as much yield as possible to make money, can those issues fall into the issues of morality, and how would we go about checking?
Yeah, I would say equal weights and measures, because Whole Foods has cash registers, mm-hmm. The food co-op has cash registers, they're taking money, everybody involved is taking money, and you've got basically. You're not going to have food if you expect farmers to grow it for free. So I believe that we really need to cultivate an understanding that when food comes to market, it's a caveat emptor sort of thing. You buyer beware. You know what the possible ramifications are. You know the heart of man. If they are in cahoots to rig the prices, to do those sorts of things, you should be wary and try to shop elsewhere. But so I don't have a Pollyanna view that if we only have free markets, everything is going to be right. But I think it's going to be a lot better than if we try to anticipate every problem and fix it before.
Hold on, Peter. So, does it matter how you treat your beef before it's killed?
Sure. If I found out that a local farmer loved to taunt his cows, it says in Proverbs that I don't know why he would do that, but suppose he did. A righteous man has regard for the life of his beast, it says in Proverbs. So, treatment of animals matters, but treatment of animals ought not to be determined by sentimental romanticism,
no.
Right? Mm-hmm. Treatment of animals is something that you can have regard for the life of your beast and still have 20,000 chickens in a big barn, and be, that's consistent with Christian morality. And if you say, well, what about these photos I saw of farmers cutting the chickens' beaks off? Well, that's because they used to peck each other. The chickens would destroy each other. So you can't just assume that I've read an article on the internet and I know animal husbandry. So basically, my problem with sweeping judgments of the food chain process is not that there isn't a moral issue there. There is, but we're not God. We're not omniscient. We need to know a whole lot more about the process than we usually do before we pass judgment. So yes, if I've got a neighbor and I see him mistreating his cows, and then he tries to make it, I'm not gonna shop at his at his butchery. I'm not gonna try and subsidize that because I know. But a lot of people think they know that mistreatment of animals is going on when in fact it just simply isn't.
Peter?
But you would grant that it's possible to know, and that not all articles on the internet are going to be the same kind of clickbait of here's the gory photo of the, you know, the beakless chicken. So I guess that takes me to this question. Would you say that part of the free market, and of course most industrial agriculture is not at all a free market because it depends heavily on government subsidies. The whole system is you know, it's part and parcel of that. But would you say that a part of that market mechanism would be organs of civil society, so-called civil society, like really competent journalists who maybe do know a thing or two about agriculture? They went to the U of I, they did agriculture for years before they went into journalism, and they exposed some kind of a really appalling conditions, not a single snapshot out of context, but the equivalent of you know, not just taunting, but even torturing the cows, and they do some kind of five-part, really good article, and it winds up in Rolling Stone, and even informed people are appalled, even those who do have the knowledge. You would say that's part of a market mechanism, and you would...
Yes.
Okay.
I would say, granting that not every article, not every muckraker is going to be lying or doing spurious work. So when they've made their case, when they've proven their case, and they say, this company is deserving of your moral condemnation. Yeah, that, I'd be happy to join in the chorus if you've proven your case. But what we're dealing with now is an ideological thing, because people just say meat producers, cattle ranchers, you know, they're as a class they're rejected, and there's bias confirmation going on in a lot of these things. But it doesn't have to be that way. And if someone makes their case, I'm willing to follow the evidence.
Totally. And I think we need to remember there is a philosophy, a growing philosophy of food that influences these people from the university. You just said, if you follow the whole foie gras issue in California, they produce so many video of how people mistreat the geese by force feeding them. And these are university professors. And this is really the reason behind that is they have a philosophy underneath, a little bit like that shop. You know, if you go on Highway 8, he says animals are people too, or something like that. You know, say, no, there is a difference. And so God gave us animals, and so you don't want to make them suffer, but yes, you kill them, you eat them. But that philosophy, that I think is influencing like the whole foie gras thing, when I looked at the video, I say, no, it's just not properly exposing the truth. And I think we have to be very wise as we watch these things.
If God didn't want us to eat animals, then why are they made out of meat?
Thank you for that insight, Pastor Wilson. I have a lot more questions, but I'm going to open up to the floor. Mrs. Edwards. Hello. Are you doing anything later? Oh, sorry. Sorry. That's my wife, just in case. Can I ask a question from that? So is nutrition a moral issue? Is it morally irresponsible to feed your children rubbish?
Yeah. So feeding your children is obviously a moral issue, but you want to always ask, by what standard? You can't just say, nutrition is good, and therefore I will quietly assume that my ideas about nutrition can be smuggled in. Everything. One of the differences between conservatives and liberals is this: liberals always think in terms of solutions. Conservatives always think in terms of trade-offs. Okay. So if you are thinking wisely, you'd say, okay, if I'm going to have a can of pears in the middle of winter in North Idaho, I will have to know a whole lot less about where those pears came from. I can open a can and I can have pears in the middle of winter. My great-great-grandfather wouldn't have been able to have pears in the middle of winter. But when he had them once a year, it would be for a month from his pear tree in the backyard. He knows a lot about the pears, but he only gets them at a certain time. I can have them year-round, right? But the trade-off, this is a trade-off. In order to have them year-round, I have to be content with knowing a lot less. The next thing is, and this is probably another moral consideration, a lot of the environmental and food, arch foodie arguments, I think, are fundamentally arguments against people. Right? It's not that one of the reasons why things are so different for us shopping in a grocery store and our great grandparents shopping at the local produce store down the street is because there's 7 billion of us. How are you going to feed those people? Well, I do not see any conceivable way of feeding all of those people created in God's image without factory farming. You know, I believe that when you look at the combine, someone just told me this morning, and I haven't had a chance to verify it, but they've told me that Whitman County, the county right next door to us, produces as much wheat as the state of Kansas. Right? It's a high yield under any circumstances. It's a high yield thing. Our combines, the mounds of corn, there are things that we do that make you want to stand up and salute. Why? Because that's dinner on the plate for millions of people on the other side of the world who have never heard of Kansas. They've never heard of Whitman County. You can't have billions of people without a food production line that is virtually incomprehensible to the average diner.
Okay. Francis?
And I agree with you on when it comes to grain or this massive production that we are able to do today because of modern technology, amazing things. But I will say also, to answer your question, between your mother and my mother when they went shopping and today, there is a difference, absolutely. But I would say as a rule of thumb, as far as nutrition, when you go to the grocery stores, look at, they are all made the same way. You walk in and you have around the grocery store and the inside. Anything around is basically fresh. Anything inside is being canned or frozen. As far as nutrition, you look at the list of ingredients of a can of food, and the list, when it goes more than three lines, I put the can back. Because there's so much there to keep that thing, that food, on the shelf for 10 years. Now, when I'm in the army, stuck somewhere like I was in the mountains, a can of food was fantastic. But that was not the way I wanted to do it if I could choose. If you could choose, then you go to that grocery store and I will go around and get fresh as much as possible. And I try to find out where it comes from, because there are more nutrition in the fresh vegetables than in the frozen vegetables, and in the fresh meat than the meat that are being sent to me from Australia. I make choices. That goes with my budget too, but there are choices there. So I think there's a balance between big factories making a lot of food, like grain is easy to do, to send somewhere across the world to feed the poor or to feed the people in need, and what you do locally when you have access to these things.
Okay, another question. Michael. So the question was, you didn't hear, about budget issues. You know, should you give to the church or buy lots of food? Not quite that blunt, but that was part of the, you know, there are budgetary issues. How do you, you know, determine what's right in terms of, and just what, someone quickly answer them?
I would just want to make one quick qualification. It's quite possible to eat very well, very cheaply. Right? Just that said.
Yeah. Yes. You just work harder to do it. It's a little bit more effort. Okay, another question. Ava? Yes. Something about food pyramids.
She asked, should there be a Christian food pyramid? Would the French one look different from the American one?
No. I don't think it will look different as far as the food pyramid, although this is changing, by the way. It's interesting how what you used to say 20 years ago, we don't say the same thing today. No, I don't think... I mean, Christians should be involved in everything, and that's why we have Christians who write books on food. That helps to understand not to fall into the two traps that we were talking earlier. And so I don't think we are doing research, and the more we find out things, the more we discover that, Christians are to study like anything else and be experts in that domain, and the difference would be that they're going to be honest They're not going to work for a big company. They're not going to be working for big money. They're going to be working for the good of the people.
Okay. Caleb, did God design chickens to live in factories?
Yes.
Anyone else want to give another option?
I think one would have to make some distinctions, but yes. It depends on what you mean by factory. What do you mean by factory?
In a cage for its whole life, not able to move.
Did God design chickens to have their necks wrung? In other words, this is what I meant by sentimental romanticism. We think, oh, the poor cow behind the fence. I doubt if that's occurred to him. Right? And particularly not to the chicken. Now, of course, I believe that you could cram chickens together in a way that would be abusive to them and not conducive to a healthy crop, etc. But God gave us dominion over the animals. And that means that a farmer who is farming for food production sake will do a lot of things that make a lot of people who enjoy it on the table squeamish if they saw how it got there.
And my chicken, by the way, are in a fence. I sing to them. They do lay eggs. No, I don't sing to them. But they are there because the coyotes, we get them every night otherwise. So I'm actually protecting them. But also, I know that the more space I give them, the better product I'm going to have. And so to me, it's not a matter of, again, a more choice is better. It's like, it's a good thing to do. And I'm giving them the choice and the joy to go around. If I get them so squeezed, they may produce some eggs, but I can guarantee the yolk won't be the same as the other eggs.
And this actually goes back to the earlier question about money. One of the things that I think ought to be kept in mind is in my earlier point about feeding the world. I have no problem with someone who has the discretionary income spending $5 on a cup of coffee or $5 on an apple. But don't pretend that you're buying the $5 apple because you're in rhythm with the natural rhythms of the peasantry around the world. You're a rich hippie and you are eating expensive apples. Well, knock yourself out. I don't have any problem with that. I have a problem with the schizophrenia that pretends to be lowly, humble, authentic, eating luxury goods. When you want to feed the world, there's got to be a trade-off, right? So yes, if you grow your own corn, except whenever I've tried it, I grow what I call third world corn. But but if someone grows their own corn and they have their wife put the pot on and they pick the corn and shuck it, and it's out of the pot in minutes, that's going to be fresher, better, glorious. And if you churned your own butter, better yet. But that's far better than getting it all out of a refrigeration truck where the corn was picked, you know, a month ago. But it's better to have the month-old corn than no corn at all, right?
Yes.
And so that's the issue, and this ties in with the fundamental table fellowship issue, which is gratitude. I believe that one of the most marked features of the modern attitude toward food is ingratitude.
Okay.
But I'd like to pick
Francis,
up something.
Francis has a lot of questions, so quickly.
Okay. Yeah. I'd just like to pick up something you said earlier, Doug, about the pear and the can.
Yes.
I do think there is something that, and that's not a more issue, it's just I think it's being smart. If you want to eat strawberries all year long, you can. Today, you can. But I tell you what, the strawberries that come from California in the winter here are disgusting. They are like rubber. There is no flavor, no juice. And I say, why pay $5 for that strawberry? And what that does is, yes, I can have strawberry all year long. They are disgusting. But really, at the end of the day, when they do come, you don't really, you say, oh, I had them last week. And you are missing something. You know, it's such a thing as working with seasons, appreciating the times of life. You know how you celebrate times? You don't party every day. If you party every day, it won't make any sense. And I say the same with food. There are seasons with food where you appreciate them more. And so if you wait for the summertime to have your strawberries, they're picked right next door. They are fresh. They're sweet. That's what God intended to be a strawberry grows in that season. Is there something wrong to grow them under plastic? No, but it's not being very smart to buy these strawberries. So that's, to me, it's more a matter of showing again the taste of things and knowing how to discipline ourselves, learning to eat within seasons. What is fresh, enjoy it because God created the seasons.
Okay, so. Thank you. Father, we thank you for the conversations we've had today, for the opportunity to discuss these things. We rejoice in the gift of food. It's a blessing from you. And as we go from here to fellowship with one another and to enjoy food that you've given us, we want to thank you for it. And we ask your blessing on our time together. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
New St. Andrew's College, thanks you for listening.